World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
The American First Army has gained 3 miles on the northern flank of the Belgian Bulge and has cut one of the two main roads supplying the Germans on that front. To the south, the enemy is increasing pressure on the American Seventh Army. A large force of Allied bombers based in Britain attacked German communications today. The Russians say they hold about two-fifths of Budapest. And in the Pacific, the Japanese say Allied warships are shelling the coast of Luzon and that a strong convoy has entered Lingayen Gulf. Observers at Pearl Harbor are awaiting news of possible further American blows in the Pacific. And now, news from Supreme Allied Headquarters. Admiral takes you direct to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
The most dramatic events on the Western Front are now occurring along the Rhine in Alsace. In this section of Europe, which has for so long been disputed by both France and Germany, questions of prestige and tradition count for quite as much as strategic considerations. The Germans have come across the Rhine in a spectacular fashion to establish themselves a few miles north of Strasbourg, and the whole French nation has its eye on that corner of the front. They are worried. Up to this morning, we had been led to believe that the German battalion which had crossed the Rhine was not much more than a raiding party. One day's rations they had, we were told, and that they were almost cleared up. Now it appears that not only do the Germans still hold most of the towns they originally entered, but they have reinforced and landed armor and motor transport. American pilots bombing German motor transport in this area put them as close as 7 miles to Strasbourg. The wary Alsatians are once more taking to the roads as the war threatens to sweep over their homes again. There is an exodus from Strasbourg and Haguenau. And south of Strasbourg, in the Colmar pocket, the Germans have also landed tanks. And today, 15 of them were attacking north toward Strasbourg. None of this is on a big scale, but it is having its effect on the French. In the Ardennes salient, where a much larger and more significant action is taking place, we have advanced in the north to cut the main east-west road in the northern half of the salient. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
That was a broadcast by Charles Collingwood, direct from Supreme Allied Headquarters. And now for more news from overseas, Admiral switches back again across the Atlantic, this time to CBS London, Richard C. Hotelet reporting.
The air offensive against the rear of the German armies in the west was kept going today by the United States 8th Air Force. More than 1,000 liberators and flying fortresses droned out from their bases in England this morning, picked up an escort of 650 fighters, and then split up over western Germany to bomb communications targets up and down the Rhine behind the western front. Two of the forces struck at the railroad yards of Neuss, just west of Dusseldorf, and at Hanau, near Frankfurt on Main, which had been plastered by strong forces of RAF bombers last night. This is not a waste of bombs, nor is it at all an indication that previous bombing was not accurate. These points are vital railheads feeding von Rundstedt's forces at the front, and the enemy has organized special commandos for the high-speed repair of rail damage. The American bombing this morning came while these crews were hard at work, and not only did more damage to the physical installations, but dislocated the repair machinery. Apart from these points, the American heavies bombed 2 Rhine bridges and also 2 other rail yards southwest of Karlsruhe that the enemy uses to supply his troops on our 7th Army front. One thing this air war had in common with the fighting on the ground was its cold. The bombers flew through temperatures of 50 degrees below. And on the ground, the whole front is in the grip of bitter cold tonight that numbs men's fingers and freezes their faces. When they're not fighting through German roadblocks and minefields, our men look around for shelter. A clump of woods, a bridge, a ruined house. And build themselves a fire to get a little warmth. BBC correspondent Robert Barr says that the woods and hills of the Ardennes look like a vast gypsy encampment. This is Richard Hotelet in London, returning you to Admiral in New York.
The British radio says today that the new Greek regent Demoskinos has received a message from British General Scobie informing him that Athens and Piraeus are now virtually free of leftist forces, and Damascenos is said to have expressed his appreciation of what he called General Scobie's unpleasant and painful tasks. The BBC also says that Scobie has invalidated his terms for a truce with the leftists. Originally, the British general asked that all ALOS forces be withdrawn from Athens and that they turn in their arms. However, Scobie now says that new terms for a truce will have to be taken into consideration, and also the fact that both sides have taken many prisoners and no truce can be established before the drawing up of conditions for taking care of prisoners and hostages. More news in just a moment, but first, here is Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral.
It's a funny thing, but right after Christmas, a lot of us begin thinking about saving money and cutting down expenses. If you're interested in saving money on foods, you'll want an Admiral dual-temp refrigerator after the war. You'll be amazed at the opportunity it'll offer to actually save money on food costs and yet give you greater food luxury and more conveniences than you've ever known. With your dual-temp refrigerator and its extra space for regular food storage, plus the Admiral built-in home freezer compartment, you'll be able to buy perishable foods at quantity prices and store them to be used as needed. Dual temp's proper temperatures for keeping foods over longer periods of time will give you value received for every food dollar you spend. You get the added advantage of the Admiral Sterilamp, too, which reduces loss by spoilage and mold. Your Admiral dual temp refrigerator will pay for itself for the money it'll save on your family's food bill. If you want to give your budget a break, make your post-war electric refrigerator an Admiral dual temp, the successor to the ordinary mechanical refrigerator. And remember, only Admiral can build a dual temp. Now, here once again is Douglas Edwards.
And for an interview with a California PBY pilot, Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
One of the greatest factors in keeping the morale of our fighting men high, both on surface ships and in the air, is the knowledge that if they're adrift in the Pacific, every effort will be made to rescue them. The story of Navy Lieutenant J.G. Joe Ball and his PBY mates is a good example. Joe's wife and son, Darwin, live at 613 North Golden Avenue in Fullerton, California. His parents, Mr. and Mrs. E.O. Ball, live at Lamar, Colorado. What makes his story so surprising is that he loaded 56 survivors into his PBY rescue plane and flew them back to safety. Will you tell us about it, Lieutenant Ball?
Well, there were five PBY crews in this rescue. We've been at this kind of work all the way from New Guinea to the Philippines. We get the word that a plane is down or a ship has been sunk, and we take off and look for them. The PBYs are very good at this because we can land almost anywhere at sea. In reasonable weather.
Well, now, where were you this time, Lieutenant?
We were based in the Philippines. We got the word that one of our destroyers had been sunk in the Ormoc Bay region. We got two planes off right away.
Now, who was piloting that other PBY?
That was Lieutenant J.G. Melvin S. Essary.
Will you spell that and tell us where he's from?
E-S-S-A-R-Y, and his home is in Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Okay. Now, did you two take off together, Lieutenant?
Yes, we did. But after we got around the north end of Lady, we spread out to get a wider search. It took us a little while to get away, though, because we had to circle to wait for the Army fighter planes to join us. They were giving us fighter escort. Those PBYs are wonderful workhorses, but they aren't very fast. And when you're operating right at the front, you have to have fighter cover.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally got to the Ormoc Bay area, over on the side of the island the Japs then held.
Were you worried about Jap fighter planes?
No, I think we were most worried about gunfire from the beach, especially after we got on the water.
Who spotted the men first?
I think everybody in the plane saw them at once. They were spread all over the ocean down there, some on life nets, a lot of them in life preservers bobbing around. We made one circle and went down and started taxiing on the sea. They were widely scattered, and we just picked them up as we came to them. Some of them were badly injured, others were very tired. They tried to swim ashore, even though it was Jap territory. But after swimming several hours, they had to give it up.
Were they in pretty good spirits?
Yes, they were. Their morale was very good. While we were working, we radioed the other PBY, and they came right in. They picked up 44 men. We got 56.
Now, how in the world did you ever get 56 men into that one plane?
Those PBYs have a lot of room in them. Although I do admit this was quite a crowd. Figuring my crew of seven, we had 63 men in that plane for the takeoff. I was worried about that because the sea was smooth.
Well, doesn't that help?
No, you can leave the water better in a seaplane when it's a little rough. We checked the engines and made a run for it. And everybody was pretty relieved when we got off. I don't know whether they gave a cheer or not, because I was sweating it out too much.
But we got back all right.
And meanwhile, three more of our PBYs went out. We were pretty happy to know that among us, we rescued every one of those survivors of that destroyer.
What'd you do then, Lieutenant Ball?
Well, next day, Essery and I went out to see if there were any lone survivors. Over this same Ormoc Bay area, I saw something that turned out to be a man hanging onto a log. I landed and found out it was a Jap survivor.
Was that a surprise? What'd you do?
We took him prisoner and flew him back.
Well, that was a happy ending to a good story. And thank you, Navy Lieutenant Joe Ball. And a salute to the good old PBY that can carry 63 men aboard and take off. This is Webley Edwards at Fleet Headquarters, Pearl Harbor. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
Japanese broadcasts are saying today that a big American invasion force is poised off Luzon near the long sandy beaches of Lingayen Gulf, and dispatches from Fleet Headquarters in Pearl Harbor and are not saying anything on that for the moment, and they're not giving any idea on what to expect next in the explosive situation in America's Western War Front. But today's communiques, it is believed, will clarify the meaning of enemy claims that task forces are roaming off the northern Philippines. Jap broadcasts early today said that American warships have attempted a landing on Luzon, the big northern Philippines island on which Manila is located, and that American warships are bombarding the coasts of Lingayen Gulf. These broadcasts, unconfirmed by any allied source, said that Jap air units are attacking the warships. Whatever the future may bring, the Japanese during the past week have learned anew of the great air and sea power of the American forces now roaming the Pacific. And now, a report from another frontline correspondent in the West. Admiral takes you to Luxembourg, Bill Shadell reporting.
This is Bill Shadell in Luxembourg. If the Germans were determined to take Bastogne, as their heavy concentration around the salient seemed to indicate the last few days, they would have started their big push today. That's the opinion of those officers and men of ours up there with whom we talked this afternoon. But there is no big offensive underway. Our perimeter, held by one of our greatest fighting outfits, the 101st Airborne Division, remains the same. At the northern tip, only 13 miles separates them from the First Army offensive coming down from the north. You can sense a certain restlessness. It's even expressed by some of those men of ours. They've met everything the Germans could throw at them. Now they'd like to be breaking out toward the north. And in spite of their losses and their hardships of the seven-day siege, they're still cocky enough to believe they could cut through those 13 miles if they were given the go-ahead. But there are other considerations, of course. The corridor, although widened, still has a stubborn enemy on both sides. Up to the time we left Bastogne early this afternoon, an advance of about 3/4 mile had been made on the left flank. The right flank shows no appreciable gain. The German has a build-up there. Too thick our artillery can't miss, but still he hangs on. Never have I seen anywhere so many dead Germans as in one spot we shelled and then advanced on 2 days ago. Despite the occasional shells coming into Bastogne from enemy lines, first services were held this morning, attended by the officers and men who were back from the lines and resting, if rest is possible anywhere within that small circle that is ours. It was an impressive service. Dirty, battle-worn, serious men, standing with helmets under their arms for the consecration. If we talk about the weather, it is only because that is one of the most impressive things of today's trip to the front. It's a long trip from this city of Luxembourg to the Bastogne front, about 2 hours in a jeep over icy roads, with the necessary stops every half hour in order to get warm. A biting wind was cutting through the open spaces between the hills of trees. A heavy snow blankets everything, including the wreckage and the dead. It lends a peculiarly detached air to each unit waiting out its own place in the line of battle. There was no fear of enemy air attack, for this was not flying weather, not in the cold winter haze that hung low over our position. During the day, the men can build small fires, that is, those who are not in the front-line outpost. Tonight, those men will try to keep warm by wrapping up in blankets and straw from nearby farms. There are dozens of hero stories up there in Bastogne. I wish I could tell you just a few of them. We heard from Sergeant Thomas Alcott of Demorah, Pennsylvania, or Sergeant Jim Curry of Somerville, New Jersey, or Corporal Harry Rogers of Steubensville, Ohio. They were in the vicious attack of January 3rd. The Germans threw in the heaviest artillery these men had seen in any of their three big campaigns. They met fanatical young Hitler youth troops who had no idea but to die.
That was Bill Shadell in Luxembourg. One of the finest stories of this war, the story of the work of Coast Guard beach parties in landing operations, has been seldom told. For an interview with a Coast Guard beach party man, here is Bill Slocum, Jr.
Unless you have had the bad luck to be in a certain rather select portions of the Coast Guard or Navy, the phrase beach party brings to mind gay and carefree afternoons on silver sands with ants in the sandwiches, sunburn, and Junior being rescued from drowning. In Coast Guard and Navy parlance, beach party is something entirely different. It's the name for the group of rugged characters who must go into an invasion beach before all other craft. It is certainly not healthy work, nor is it a job for persons sensitive to sudden loud noises. With me today is a hardened veteran of many a beach party in the Pacific. This hardened veteran wears a chest full of medals, one of them the coveted Silver Star. He claims to be 25, looks about 18, wears two full stripes of a Coast Guard lieutenant, and except for the premature dignity that war and rank must bring, he reminds you of that nice kid next door who always opens the door for old ladies and whistles at young ones. His name is Matthew P. Cantillon, and he comes from Shaker Heights, Ohio. Lieutenant Cantillon, tell us how you won that Silver Star.
I'm not sure. I guess they just had an extra one laying around.
That was an unfair question. Let's put it this way. Where were you on the day of May 28, 1944?
I was at Biak in New Guinea with a beach party. Our beach party had landed to set up guides for the craft that were to follow.
Any complications?
Well, a few. We had been landed on the wrong part of the beach, and when we went off to the correct site, we found a few Japs with rifles and machine guns had it covered. They were in caves. Oh, yes. The Navy was dropping big shells in that area, too.
Well, what did you do?
Nothing.
Nothing?
That's right. We were perfectly willing to let the Navy knock those Japs out of a cave. Then we'd set up our beach.
So you just set it out?
Well, not exactly, Mr. Slocum. There had been a landing further down the beach, and the Army started yelling for more supplies. Supplies that were to be landed on our beach. Because of the time element, I asked for volunteers. So R.T. Snyder and Nicholas Pryor came along, and the three of us dropped a few hand grenades into the Jap cave. It killed all the Japs, and we landed our supplies.
Well, had you had much practice with hand grenades, Lieutenant?
I never saw one before or since in my life.
Well, I don't want to ask anything personal, Lieutenant, but how did you manage to use them if you never saw them before?
Well, we asked the Army man we borrowed them from. He told us to pull the pin, hold the lever down, and then duck. We did all three, particularly the last.
Well, how far did you throw those hand grenades?
Well, we didn't really throw them. We just tossed them in the cave.
Well, that meant you and Snyder and Parara had to crawl in broad daylight up to the mouth of that cave to stop those Japs?
Well, yes, I guess it did.
Well, yes, I know it did, because I saw the Coast Guard citation awarding you and your two mates the Silver Star for gallantry and intrepidity in action. Thanks very much, Lieutenant Matthew Cantillon, first for your gallantry and intrepidity on BIAC, and second for your gallantry and intrepidity on this broadcast. Now, back to Doug Edwards.
For an interview with an Air Corps colonel who recently returned from the Western Front, Admiral takes you now to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
One of the hottest stories of the Western Front is the close cooperation between the foot soldiers slogging through the mud and the Air Corps. Our guest this afternoon has lived the story from the first days of the Second Front, through the breakthrough at Caen, chasing the Germans back into their fixed positions, and then the bloody fighting on the Aachen Front inside Germany. He is Colonel George L. Wurtenbaker, at 28 commander of a fighter group. He flew with the 9th Air Force and holds a Distinguished Flying Cross, Air Medal, and 10 Oak Leaf Clusters. The last time he broadcast for us, incidentally, was in a tent at Normandy. Colonel, I'd like to ask you, as an Air Corps officer, what you think of the infantry.
Those boys are wonderful. They can do just about anything. I've lived with them some, been on the front with them, and I'm telling you it takes a lot of guts to fight in the mud with the sights and sounds of war around you all the time. The job of my outfit was to help the infantry do its final job, and I've done a lot of things in the Air Corps, but I can tell you there's no greater personal satisfaction than knowing you are doing some good for those boys on the ground.
Well, just what did the fighter pilots do to help the infantry?
Our job was to neutralize or destroy the enemy strong points holding up the infantry advance by dive bombing and strafing of roads and vehicles. It takes a lot of knowing to do this right. Sometimes we had to dive bomb within 100 yards of the troops, and we had to use delayed fuses on our bombs to keep from getting blown up ourselves. We came in pretty low over the target, sometimes 500 feet. You had to be careful, for example, when you were dive bombing tanks, because if you got too close, you'd blow your own ship up. If you got too far away, your artillery was affected. It's just one of those choices you have to make.
Well, weren't the camouflaged German pillboxes in the Aachen Front pretty hard to see, Colonel?
They were, of course, but we got grand help from the ground. The people on the ground, through radio contact, would take us right up over the target. And then if we still couldn't see it, we'd call down to the infantry or artillery for help. The boys on the ground would mark the target with colored smoke.
Is there any way of estimating how effective this fighter cooperation with the ground effort has been?
Well, I figure my own group knocked out around 1,600 enemy vehicles, tanks, armored cars, trucks, and trailers. One of my men ran up quite a record. He alone accounted for about 100 Nazi vehicles.
Well, how does the infantry feel about the job you fighter pilots have been doing?
My own outfit was presented with a captured German flag by the infantry. And let me tell you, that really is a prized possession. It meant an awful lot to the pilots. I remember one day we were sent up to knock out some enemy strong points. The soldiers had been held up by German mortars and heavy machine guns. As we were flying back, we saw the GI standing in the road waving their arms and yelling. It's things like that that make our work so satisfying.
I imagine one of the big problems was getting the infantry and the Air Corps people to understand each other's problems. How did you work that out?
We sent pilots up to the front, to the foxholes, to find out how these boys lived. And we had some of the infantry people come over and see our show. We regularly send pilots down to the ground to act as liaison and assistants to the infantry people. They ride up front with the tanks. And when these pilots come back, they're full of the grand way the foot soldiers do things. I think we now have a real comradeship in arms. It's been worth it to know that you are helping the infantry, and we are now going to work together all the way to Berlin.
Thank you, Colonel Wurtenbaker. I return you to New York.
And once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral. Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers, will have many more firsts for you when the war is won.
Mr. Sweeney, after the war, I want one of those little radios you carry around on a strap over your shoulder. I mean the kind that'll run on either batteries or house current. Do you think Admiral will make those?
Yes, the Admiral radio line will be complete. And as for those personal type radios, the three-way Bantam radio was an Admiral first. The post-war Admiral Bantam will be improved and better than ever.
Well, I want one of those. And we'll need a new radio phonograph combination for our home, too.
Then Admiral is the post-war buy for you. Remember, only Admiral can give you Slide Away, the exclusive feature that makes your automatic record changer so easy to load and unload. And the new Admiral automatic record changer will be so efficient in its operation and so trouble-free that America's choice in the post-war years will be Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Nothing is more important to our men and women overseas than mail from home. So write often. V-mail is ideal for short, newsy, frequent letters. With V-mail, you can write at least 200 handwritten words or 500 typewritten words. And remember, V-mail flies overseas. Write your serviceman today, V-mail. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral dual-temp refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is Warren Sweeney reporting coast to coast
for Admiral. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.